From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, March 31st, 2017. And on this day, the Elver season gets off to a slow start, and we'll visit a new facility that aims to support women prisoners so they don't become repeat offenders or victims in the drug war. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
First tonight, as a spring snowstorm comes into the state, a look ahead to the summer season and the troubles thereof. Maine Senator Angus King's leading an effort to reform a temporary work visa program that many Maine inns and restaurants depend on for seasonal help. Congress plans to issue fewer H-2B visas this year than last year, and businesses in states with relatively late tourist seasons, like Maine, are scrambling to find staffing alternatives. King, who's an independent, Maine's Republican Senator Susan Collins, Democratic Senator Tim Warner of Virginia, and several others are co-sponsoring what they call the Save Our Small and Seasonal Businesses Act. The bill would exempt those who have previously worked in the U.S. from the program's existing cap, potentially allowing tens of thousands more work visas into the mix. Maine Marine Resources officials say the state's Elver season is getting off to a slow start, with only small numbers of the tiny eels being netted by harvesters. As A.J. Higgins reports, the quality and quantity of the juvenile eels are expected to improve as temperatures climb in April.
Maine's Elver season opened on March 22nd, but the fishing has been poor, according to State Department of Marine Resources spokesman Jeff Nichols, who says colder than normal temperatures have kept landings down.
Things are pretty slow. I mean, this has been a very cold spring, and, you know, we've got more snow on the way, which suggests that the water temperature is probably going to remain pretty cold. But we do anticipate, with warming waters, you know, the migration is going to happen. The Elvers are going to show up and things will pick up. But at this point, you know, what we're hearing is that things are pretty slow.
During banner demand years, the baby eels have been gobbled up by the Asian market to drive prices above $2,000 per pound. According to the State Department of Marine Resources, last year, nearly 1,000 fishermen landed more than 9,300 pounds of Elvers, also known as glass eels, that were valued at more than $13 million. DMR spokesman Nichols says the industry expects average value similar to last year, when the eels were selling for a little more than $1,400 per pound. Maine is restricted to an annual eel harvest quota of just under 9,700 pounds. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
A compromise is in the works that could end weeks of pitched battle in Portland over the scope of a school bond to go before voters. Fred Bever has details.
Mayor Ethan Strimling and City Councilor Nick Mavadones announced a deal to give voters two choices: whether to pay $64 million to fund renovations to four city elementary schools, or just $32 million to renovate two of the schools. Strimling says that without a compromise, the council might not have agreed to put any measure before the voters.
For those of us who have been advocating so hard for the $64 million ballot question, getting it on the ballot was the most important piece.
Some councilors argue that the city should wait to see how much money the state might kick in for renovations before asking voters for the full $64 million. Under the compromise, which still has to be approved by the entire council, whichever question on the November ballot gets the most yes votes will win, as long as it's more than 50% of the total votes cast. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
This month, about 70 women inmates formerly held in York County moved into the Southern Maine Women's Reentry Center in Windham. It's a brand new facility designed to house close to 100 minimum security prisoners who have less than 4 years remaining on their sentences. The reentry center will temporarily ease a chronic overcrowding problem, but the main purpose is to give the women support so they don't become repeat offenders or victims in the drug war.
Like most women who end up in prison, Alexandra Garso, Alicia Jameson, and Jessica Alexander are all mothers. And like most, they are here for crimes associated with opioid addiction. Garso was convicted of a home invasion charge.
I got 5 years. My release date will be sometime in March of next year.
Alicia Jameson had her probation revoked in 2015.
My initial charge was a theft and forgery charge. Just addiction kind of took over. I was failing my urine test and not being able to pay restitution.
And Jessica Alexander says she'd been sober for 3 years when she made a crucial mistake and violated the terms of her probation for theft.
I got an unexpected visitor and was like, oh, let's go shopping and do some heroin. And I'm like, oh, okay. They lost all them days of sobriety in an hour.
All three women are spending the remainder of their sentences at the Southern Maine Women's Reentry Center. It's a modern and less restrictive facility than prison, with 4 separate living areas, comfortable furniture, and natural light. There are no bars on the windows or heavy slamming doors. The classrooms and dining area are smaller than usual. And Warden Scott Landry says there's a reason for the friendlier design.
Most women that are here have had trauma. They've experienced abuse in one way, shape, or form. They are triggered by things in their environment. So hearing slamming doors or hearing loud noises is not conducive to getting them to feel safe and have a mindset that is going to help them be responsive to the treatment and programming that we're trying to offer.
That includes working on a case plan, getting counseling and support for addiction, taking parenting and other classes, and, says Garso, learning how to let go of emotional pain.
At an early age, my mom passed away, and I held on to the anger for a very long time. And I always use it as a justification for my actions.
The women credit their teachers and caseworkers here with helping them face down their demons.
I would take back my crime in a heartbeat, but everything that I've learned here, I wouldn't take any of that back.
Yeah.
Because it's made me a way better person than I've ever been. I actually like who I am now, and I'm happy with myself.
I've found myself again. So as much as, you know, this is not the ideal, I don't think I would have ever have gotten back who I was before the addiction took over.
To know that you are actually in control of your emotions, feelings, and surroundings, like, to learn about that and to how to control a situation, it's amazing to me. I'm 41 years old. I thought I would know that.
Hi there.
What are you guys making?
We are just actually refashioning some leftovers that we've compiled for the last probably 2 days.
In the kitchen, culinary arts instructor Krista Okerholm is showing several women how to make a vegetarian tortilla bake that they'll serve for dinner. Those with experience in the kitchen have gone on to find work in restaurants, and says Okerholm, a few have started their own catering business after prison. Here, on-the-job training and experience is encouraged, even if it means starting small.
You know, for me, I worked at Dunkin' Donuts, and I loved it, and I never, ever thought I would do something like that.
Alicia Jameson got the job at Dunkin' Donuts in Sanford while she was at the York County Pre-Release Center. She says she liked the interaction with customers and her coworkers. Alexandra Garso worked at a factory that turned out dog toys, athletic cleats, and other products. Now that she's in Wyndham, she wants to find a job nearby to keep her occupied and to earn money to send home to her 3 kids who live with their dad.
So I can send money out, and I bought my daughter a cell phone, and I pay for her bill every month so she can have her cell phone as a reward for doing so good in school.
The women in work release are required to pay 20% of what they earn for rent and to put away 10% in savings. They can also pay fines and restitution. And Officer Brittany Falco says that gives them a head start when they get out.
Allowing them to have money to release with and fines paid off, you know, they have that off their backs. I mean, it's a lot less reasons to recidivate.
In addition to earning some money, the idea is for the women to be able to better cope with the world when they're released. That means having mentors, sponsors, and strengthening relationships with family members, especially their kids. In the visitor's room, there are toys, an outdoor play space, and a small kitchen so meals can be shared together. As they make progress on their case plans and get closer to release, They can also go on furloughs and overnights. Jameson says she likes the freedom, but parting with her 5-year-old son, Bentley, at the end of a visit is tough.
He always says, "Mama, I just want to spend the night with you," you know, because we kind of haven't gone down that road exactly where I am. He hasn't so much really come out and asked, and I'm just not sure how much I want to say at 5 about prison.
The extra burden they have put on their families is something these women say they are regularly forced to confront. Garceau's daughters still get upset and cry when she tells them she isn't coming home for a while. She often consoles them over the phone. 2 years ago, she found out she was pregnant with a child she's still trying to get to know.
Like I said, I gave birth to my son in here. I don't have the same connection I have with my 2 daughters with him. And it helps me to get out and him see me in a normal setting and get to know me in a normal setting and see how we can interact with each other.
But there's nothing normal about having a mother in prison. It's just that their numbers are growing. Scott Landry says when he took over as warden, there were about 150 women in the Maine prison system. Now, 4 years later, there are 220. And the women's section is beyond capacity. Landry says about 80 inmates are living in an overflow space. The new reentry center will help absorb some of them.
It's kind of scary as far as what the outlook is. Until we see some relief with the opiate crisis, until we see proactive efforts upstream to try to prevent women from being incarcerated in the first place, I think we're going to see more of the same. And this is a national trend, not just a local trend.
Local trend or not, Garceau, Jameson, and Alexander don't plan on coming back. Garceau is looking at a 7-year prison sentence if she gets into trouble again. And she can't bear the thought of putting her children through that. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
When Maine author Ron Curry started working on his new novel a few years ago, he couldn't have known how timely it would be when it came out in the spring of 2017. In an era when absolute truths seem increasingly difficult to grasp, The One-Eyed Man concerns Kay, an average guy who loses his wife to cancer and then loses his ability to understand anything but the absolute truth. Kay becomes very literal, and his inability to process both his grief and metaphor and his insistence on telling the whole truth all the time lead to various adventures. I spoke with Curry, who grew up in Waterville and now lives in Portland, about the book and about Kay.
He has lost his ability to understand metaphor. So he takes everything very literally, which, if you stop to think about it, would make life in today's world pretty difficult. Like, for example, at the very beginning of the book, he is walking to get a cup of coffee, and he encounters a crossing sign that says don't walk, so he doesn't walk. But the crossing sign is broken and it won't change, so he stands out there for 12 hours waiting for it to change, and it never does. So that's sort of the way that he moves and sometimes fails to move through the world.
There's kind of a wild ride plot in this book, and there's a lot made of Kay's inability to deal with people in a sort of normal human way. But I think one of the more interesting things about this book is that Kay does have these relationships with several people in the book throughout it that are really very meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, starting with Claire, who works at what in the book is referred to as Total Foods Supermarket. They meet at Total Foods, and she ends up being fired from her job as a consequence of that meeting. And in the meantime, or simultaneously, Kay is offered a reality TV show, and Claire becomes his sort of sidekick on this show. She's very wry, very irreverent. She has a little bit of a drinking problem. She's actually my favorite character in the book. I love her. The more meaningful relationships between Kay and other men in the book are probably between him and Theodore, who's the producer of the show. And Theodore is a really interesting character because he's coming to Kay in the midst of a crisis of conscience himself. He's been making reality TV for a very long time. His credits include Pimp House, Funeral Home Confessions, I mean, real garbage TV. And he's decided he wants to do something more meaningful, but he's stuck within the realm of reality TV. So he endeavors to do something with Kay because he sees an opportunity to have somebody confront what Theodore sees as a dearth of truth and honesty in the culture.
Now, you are from Maine. You grew up in Maine. You've lived in Maine for your whole life. And there's a lot of Maine in this book, but not necessarily the Maine that we often see in literature. Tell me how your experience of Maine informs this book.
I certainly had Portland and environs in mind when I was writing it. And I don't refer to Portland specifically in the text at all, but even a casual read will reveal that that's the place that I'm writing about primarily, even though the narrative jumps around all over the country.
There's also, I think, the only reference I've ever seen in literature to Allen's Coffee Brandy.
You know, I went to New York once and tried to get a Rumford Martini at a bar, and the person looked at me like I had two heads. Nobody outside of Maine has any idea what Allen's is. So I suppose that alone reveals, you know, place more than anything else in the book. The fact that he's drinking Rumford Martinis with his mother-in-law certainly anchors it in Maine.
This book looks a lot at sort of the nature of truth. It seems very timely.
Given everything that's happened in the last few months, I thought that I would probably be, or the book would be perceived as prescient in some way, but it's really not in my mind because I started writing it 4 years ago, and one of the things that was foremost in my mind when I began writing the book was what I saw as the amount of nonsense that I was surrounded by every day, whether on social media, certainly in advertising, certainly in politics, and the ways in which it was sort of insinuating itself into our real lives. So, you know, that was one of the central themes of the book, and it surprised me come election time that so many people were surprised by the fact that this stuff had real-life consequences. If I had written it 50 years ago, it would be prescient, you know, but now, I don't know, I think we're all just coming to realize that we've been immersed in this environment for a long time, and it really shouldn't have come as any surprise that this was so consequential.
All right, Ron Curry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can find a longer version of this interview and more interviews with Maine authors and artists at mainepublic.org. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Friday, March 31st, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty. Have a great weekend.